Chapter 5. O Brave New World, Literature, Misogyny, and the Rise of Modernity. Even as the pall of smoke still hung over Europe from the raging fires of the witch-hunts, a new world began to emerge in the 16th and 17th centuries, dimly perceived at first. It would not be a world free from misogyny. In fact, the term itself would be first used in 1656, but it was a world that challenged the authorities on whose dogmas and doctrines misogyny rested. Between 1500 and 1800 occurred a series of revolutions, intellectual, social, economic, and political, that would transform not only Europe, but eventually the entire world. Never before had authority come under such scrutiny. What was regarded as sacred was challenged. Many of the old certainties collapsed. Out of the rubble emerged the modern world. This was neither a straightforward nor a consistent process, nor at times did it seem to have anything to do with the status of women. When Galileo Galilei, 1564 to 1642, climbed the steep stone stairs of the Campanile in the Piazza San Marco in Venice in 1609 and pointed a crude optical instrument called a telescope at the night sky, how would what he saw challenge a civilization's view of women? What he saw through his telescope was a universe on the move, not the fixed, unchanging spheres of an Earth-centered cosmos, as had been taught for more than 2,000 years. His observations, which he believed supported the theory of the sun-centered solar system of Copernicus, challenged the teachings of the Church, the Bible, and Aristotle, the main pillars of authority on which the medieval view of the world and women had rested. If Galileo's discoveries showed that the ancient authorities, including even the Bible, could get the nature of the cosmos wrong, how reliable were they on other matters, including the nature and status of women? But it would prove easier to gain credence that the earth moves round the sun than it would to shift traditional misogynistic prejudices and practices. As of 1600 in England, socially and intellectually among the more progressive countries in Europe, legally a woman had no rights at all, other than those recognised by local custom. Her father had charge of her until she was married, when she came under the authority of her husband, who took absolute control of all her personal property. As the law of the time stated, "That which a man hath is his own, that which the wife hath is the husband's." Women could become queens in the 16th century, and, like Elizabeth I, command and inspire fear and respect. But by the beginning of the 17th century, their status had, if anything, declined. Contemporary Platonists debated whether or not women had souls. At the level of dress, always an indication of women's status, their suffering was taken for granted. The late 17th century fashion was to encase women's bodies in tight corsets. At the autopsy of one young woman who died at age 20, it was found that her ribs had grown into her liver, and that her other entrails were much hurt by being crushed together with her stays, which her mother had ordered to be twitched so straight that it often brought tears into her eyes whilst the maid was dressing her. Young women were also constantly subjected to purges and enemas to maintain a fashionably pallid complexion. Men who murdered their wives were hanged, but women who murdered their husbands suffered the same terrible fate as traitors and were burned at the stake. By the end of the 18th century, by which time most educated people accepted the theory of a sun-centered solar system, the struggle for legal reforms to marriage in favour of women was as yet in its infancy. Marriage still suspended a woman's legal existence, incorporating it into that of her husband, under whose wing, protection and cover, she performs everything. However, changes as a result of the religious, social and political revolutions beginning with the Reformation would challenge misogyny as never before. While the legal situation of women within marriage remained oppressive, the Reformation caused the status of marriage itself to undergo a dramatic change, affecting the relationship between husband and wife. It also cast the issue of women's education into a new light. The Reformers' rejection of priestly celibacy was at the heart of their revolt against the Catholic Church. By allowing clergy to marry, they raised the status of marriage, which the Catholic Church had viewed as very much an inferior state. This put husbands and wives on a more equal footing than was common before. Women had taken a prominent role in the religious upheavals following Martin Luther's declaration of the 95 Articles, which provoked an irreparable break with Catholicism in 1517. However, the convulsions that pitched women into active and public roles, even allowing a few of them to command the pulpit, inevitably created great unease. As the new Protestant faith stabilized and the revolutionary fervor abated, so did the willingness of the reformers to grant women equality. In 1558, the founder of Scottish Protestantism, John Knox, published a pamphlet entitled "The First Blast Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women," attacking the more prominent role women were taking in the new faith. The patriarchal family was, if anything, reinforced. Now Father not only knew best, but he knew better than the priest, whose role he adopted to the extent of leading the family in daily prayers and in conducting readings from the Bible. Woman's subordinate role was reaffirmed, as summed up in the words of the great English Puritan poet John Milton, 1608-74. "He for God only, she for God in him." According to Lawrence Stone, "The ideal woman in the 16th and 17th centuries was weak, submissive, charitable, virtuous and modest, like the wife of the Massachusetts minister in the 1630s, whom he publicly praised for her incomparable meekness of spirit, towards myself especially." But it was not that simple. Relations within marriage had been set on a course towards greater conjugal intimacy from which they would not be deflected until they produced the nuclear family. Just as, with the astronomical revolution started by Copernicus, the wrecking ball of science was delivering its first major blow against the authority of the Bible, the Reformation was declaring biblical authority as essential to faith. Ironically, however, that declaration was good for women, because reliance on Scripture implied that it was important for all Protestants, male and female, to be able to read, thus raising the vital matter of women's education. There had been earlier advocates of education for women. In the 15th century, the poet and scholar Christine de Pisa had written, "If it were customary to send little girls to school and to teach them the same subjects as are taught boys, they would learn just as fully and would understand the subtleties of all arts and sciences." In 1552, a pamphlet published in England argued that women's disabilities were a result not of nature, but of the bringing up and training of women's life. There was something of a movement in favour of the education of women, among whose exponents was the philosopher St. Thomas More, the author of Utopia, the most influential vision of an ideal society since Plato's The Republic. "I do not see why learning may not equally agree with both sexes," he wrote. But the following century, the idea was still deeply opposed, often at the highest levels. King James I denounced the notion. "To make women learned and foxes tame had the same effect, to make them more cunning," he said, expressing the misogynistic prejudice of the centuries, though it is worthwhile to note that it was a slight against the character of women, not their intelligence. King James's opinion prevailed for a time. It is estimated that as of 1600 in London, the London of Shakespeare, only 10% of women could read. Within 40 years it had risen to 20%. Outside of the city, the situation was worse. As of 1754, only one woman out of three in England could sign her name in the registry of marriages, compared to slightly less than two-thirds of men. By that date, the total population of England was around 6 million. Ironically, considering his opposition to women's education, it was under King James that the first great translation of the Bible into English was undertaken, creating an incentive for English Protestants to teach their daughters to read in order to acquaint them first-hand with the Word of God, a vital defence against the blandishments of the still-powerful Catholic Church. In nature, we have as clear an understanding as men, if we were bred in schools to mature our brains, wrote Margaret, Duchess of Newcastle. But upper-class and well-educated women like the Duchess of Newcastle were mercilessly derided and satirised on the stage for their ability to read Greek and Latin. The Plato in petticoats became a standard figure of fun for daring to defy male notions of women's intellectual capacities. However, the broader benefits of educating women were gradually gaining acceptance. With the rise of the middle class from the mid-17th century onwards, another important incentive to educate women came into play, the development of the notion of marriage as companionship and the subsequent need for a wife to be a fitting companion for her husband, someone with whom he might hold an intelligent conversation. By 1697, Daniel Defoe, 1660-1731, one of the most influential writers of his time, was a strong advocate for women's education. Defoe had good cause to champion the education of women. As one of the first novelists, he knew that women were a growing part of his readership. These developments were the manifestation of a much deeper social transformation that would have a major impact on women's status. According to Bertrand Russell, the modern world, so far as mental outlook is concerned, begins in the 17th century. An essential part of that outlook took root in Holland, England, and the North American colonies. It was defined by revolutionary notions concerning the importance of the individual, stressing equality, and the pursuit of happiness. The concept of individual autonomy, as it emerged in the early modern period, involved a redefinition of the relationship between men, their government, and society, and the responsibilities that each bore to each. Making the individual, not God, central to the scheme of things was a shift of emphasis that would have revolutionary consequences for the status of women. All these ideas were central to the thinking of the English philosopher John Locke, 1632-1704, who laid the foundations for the philosophy of liberalism. Locke attacked the notion that the structure of the family must reflect the patriarchal structure of society, where the king as the head of state was a model for the rule of the father over his household. He offered a more fluid theory of family, state, and the individual's relationship to the state. Linked to his concept of autonomy were ideas of equality and the right of the individual to pursue happiness. Locke declared that all men by nature are born equal, and that the necessity of pursuing true happiness is the foundation of all liberty. Perhaps as importantly, Locke was an empiricist who argued that all human beings are at birth a blank slate on which circumstances, especially upbringing and education, inscribe the thing we call human nature. The blank slate hypothesis located the causes of human behavior not in the brain, but primarily in the world outside. Eventually, the blank slate hypothesis would replace that of original sin as the primal state of being for us all. For women, the implications of this were profound. If, like a man, a woman was a blank slate at birth, then her inferiority was not inherent to her nature or predetermined by it, but was a product of her upbringing and education. It called into question one of the foundation stones of misogyny. Genesis had decreed that the subjection of women to their husbands and their suffering in childbirth were punishments for Eve's part in the fall of man. In Two Treatises of Government, Locke adopted a common-sense approach and declared, "There is no more law to oblige a woman to such subjection, if the circumstances either of her condition or contract with her husband should exempt her from it, than there is that she should bring forth her children in sorrow and pain, if there could be found a remedy for it, which is also part of the same curse upon her." Since Locke equated good with pleasure and evil with pain, it made no sense to endure suffering if it could be avoided. He was among the first to protest against the fashion of encasing women's bodies in tight corsets. It is not hard to imagine how much of a challenge this was to the prevailing order, where subordination of women was part of the divine plan and a model of the very structure of the cosmos. The idea that women could escape what is deemed their biological fate remains for some an affront to what they believe is God or Allah's grand design, and has been fiercely opposed over the centuries. The churches would cry out against the use of chloroform to ease the pangs of childbirth in the 19th century. Conservative Catholics and fundamentalist Protestants would campaign, sometimes with violence, against contraception and abortion in the 20th. The implications of liberalism were impossible to avoid almost as soon as the principles from which they derived were formulated. English women did not need to wait for Locke to formulate the new philosophy with all its ramifications. In 1642, for the first time since the late Roman Republic, women took to the streets in political protest. Some 400 assembled outside the English Parliament to protest their financial hardships. During the English Civil War, 1642-9, women belonging to one of the more radical sects chanted, "We shall not be wives and tie up our lives in villainous slavery." Within 2 years of Locke's death, Mary Astell, 1668-1731, often described as the first English feminist writer and the author of A Serious Proposal to the Ladies, 1694-7, and Some Reflections Upon Marriage, 1700, posed the inevitable question. If all men are born free, how is it that all women are born slaves? The application of liberal notions about the rights of the individual had already led to improvements in women's status in the colonies of North America. In 1647, Massachusetts passed a law forbidding husbands to beat their wives. But the influence of liberalism went much further. It helped create a whole new notion of the family as a unit based on affection as well as on authority. Locke envisioned the family as a power-sharing unit in which the mother, too, has her share with the father. This, in turn, revolutionized the rules regarding the role of sex between husband and wife. It also undermined the parents' control over their children's choice of whom to marry. As Stone has pointed out, how could paternal control over the choice of marriage partner be maintained if the pair were now to be bound by ties of love and affection? The idea that husbands and wives might have intercourse for mutual comfort as well as for procreation signalled a loosening of control of the churches and other authorities over sexual behaviour. The traditional misogyny of Christianity had tolerated sex between men and women as, regrettably, the only means that was available to human beings to reproduce. This, fundamentally, remains the attitude of the Catholic Church to this day. From St. Paul onwards, the basic attitude of Christianity towards sex was that it was a shameful act, more shameful if enjoyed. However, as society became more secular, so did sex. This process did not by any means move inexorably forward. Periods of sexual liberation have always been countered by periods of conservative backlash. But the development of more liberal attitudes to sex was accelerated after the failure of the Puritan Revolution in England, 1647-60, when there was a moral revolt against the religious zealots who, during the rule of Oliver Cromwell, had shut down theatres, banned cockfighting, and closed taverns. The Puritans may have won the Civil War, but in their war against pleasure, they were decisively defeated. Prizing apart sex from the divine plan inevitably led to an increasing emphasis on its recreative rather than its procreative function. This was made easier by the invention of the condom, which first became available in London and Paris in the 17th century. Though initially used as a prophylactic against venereal infection, the condom was soon functioning as a contraceptive device. The condom represented the first major step towards the transformation of sexual activity into a pursuit that was mainly, not just occasionally, recreational. The ability of women to protect themselves and avoid pregnancy challenged the biological determinism that lies behind so much misogyny. The anxiety that this creates, today as in the 17th century, is often disguised in moralizing that such protection makes women even more vulnerable to men's lusts. But it cannot hide the essential fear of women controlling their reproductive fate, thus achieving the autonomy that all misogynists dread. As the possibility of one form of autonomy began glimmering into view, science laid to rest the fantasy of another, that of the autonomous male that lies behind the Greek myth of creation and Aristotle's scientific exposition of the lesser, even dispensable role women play in reproduction. For millennia, both reduced the role of women to that of a pouch to nurture the all-life-giving seed. However, with the invention of the microscope, a miniature world was opened up that was as fascinating as anything that the telescope had revealed. In 1672, the ovaries were discovered. It was gradually realized that a woman's role in conception was not that of the passive incubator with the male seed carrying all the essentials of life, including the soul, as had been propounded since Aristotle. Her eggs were shown to be essential to the creation as well as the sustenance of life. Athena might one day spring from a petri dish, but never from her father Zeus's head. The rise of science, the advancement of reason, the birth of democratic ideas, and the development of a philosophy centred on the individual did not, however, banish misogyny, no more than the intellectual triumphs of the Greeks did 2,000 years earlier. Misogyny, like all prejudices, is often most powerfully felt as a reaction to changes that threaten its underlying assumptions. It must be remembered that the most lethal form of misogyny in history, witch hunting, reached its peak in the 17th century, even as Locke was elucidating the rights of the individual and protesting against tight corsets. Every age, as the poet T.S. Eliot remarked, is an age of transition. But the 17th century was one of the most turbulent in human history, riven by moral, intellectual, social and political conflicts that have left their mark on the subsequent centuries. In literature, misogyny never went out of fashion in Europe during the period that we identify as the birth of the modern world. The 16th century and early 17th produced a rich crop of misogynistic writing. It ranged from scurrilous pamphlets, most notoriously Joseph Swetman's The Arraignment of Lewd, Idle, Forward and Unconstant Woman, which went through 10 editions between 1616 and 1634, to the morbid and bitter denunciations in the work of the finest of the Elizabethan and Jacobean poets and dramatists. Misogyny did not want for exponents. It was not the first time that alongside lyric poetry devoted to praising women for their beauty, there should run the sewer of misogyny, often issuing from the pen of the same poet. The French poet Clément Marot composed a poem in praise of women's breasts that created a literary fashion. A little ball of ivory, in the middle of which sits a strawberry or cherry. When one sees you, many men feel the desire within their hands to touch you and to hold you. Later, he composed its opposite. Breast that is nothing but skin, flaccid breast, flag-like breast, like that of a funnel, breast with a big, ugly, black lip, breast that's good for nursing Lucifer's children in hell. Many of these attacks on women are part of a rhetorical convention and consist mostly of hoary clichés that go back to the Greek and Roman misogynistic tradition. In English, it persisted through the 18th century as a major literary tradition. In Epicoene, or The Silent Woman by Ben Jonson, 1573 to 1637, a husband, Captain Otter, describes his wife in a manner that would have been understood, excepting the contemporary references, by the Roman poet Juvenal. Oh, most vile face! And yet she spends me £40 a year in mercury and hog's bones. All her teeth were made in Blackfriars, both her eyebrows in the Strand, and her hair in Silver Street. Every part of the town owns a piece of her. She takes herself asunder still when she goes to bed into some 20 boxes, and about the next day noon is put together again like a great German clock. Misogynists deploy anti-makeup propaganda in every age with more or less the same tedious lament, but a more psychologically disturbing anxiety arises that focuses on the independence of women. Epicoene features a coterie of independent women known as the collegiates, who spend their time discussing poetry, politics, and philosophy. Their independence is underscored by the fact that they can afford to ride around London in their own coaches. Their masculine traits stand in contrast to the male characters, who, like Captain Otter, are effeminized through their failure to control their wives. Gender roles are switched, as the independent women become masculine and the weak men become effeminate. The collegiates are accused of pursuing sex for pure pleasure, like men, and of sleeping with each other. The result is moral and social chaos and disorder. Such women were the target of scathing satire by Jonson and his contemporaries. Of one woman called Marilla, who, like the collegiate women, dared to ride around in her own coach, one supposes it was the Elizabethan equivalent of a woman roaring around on a motorbike, the satirist William Goddard wrote, "Speak. Could you judge her less than be some man? If less than this, I'm sure you'd judge at least she was part man, part woman, part a beast. In The Taming of the Shrew, William Shakespeare, 1564 to 1616, then an up-and-coming young playwright, dealt with the prevailing anxiety over women's domestic rebellion. The play is a perennially popular comedy, which is both raucous and erotic. It deals with the issue of sex and power, and its ending, while ostensibly representing an outright male triumph, is framed somewhat ambiguously. No man will marry the heroine Catherine Minola of Padua because she is in a state of permanent insurrection about the prospect of being subservient to her husband. Petruchio, desperately needing to get married for economic reasons, proves her match. Catherine's concession speech in Act 5, Scene 2, is a plea to women to surrender and abandon their struggle with men for dominance.
Fie, fie! Unknit that threatening, unkind brow, and dart not scornful glances from those eyes to wound thy lord, thy king, thy governor. It blots thy beauty as frosts do bite the meads, confounds thy fame as whirlwinds shake fair buds. Thy husband is thy lord, thy life, thy keeper, thy head, thy sovereign, one that cares for thee and for thy maintenance, commits his body to painful labour both by sea and land, while thou liest warm at home, secure and safe.
To the male audience, it may be gratifying to see a woman hoist the white flag so conspicuously. The Taming of the Shrew seems to celebrate a return to the status quo, with woman as subject and man master. However, in the play, appearance and reality are confused. It is often forgotten that this is a play within a play. The Taming of the Shrew is an entertainment that two noblemen stage to dupe a henpecked and drunken beggar named Sly into believing that he is a lord. When it ends, they dump him on the street and he falls into an alcoholic stupor. Sly is reawakened from his dream of lordship to face the prospect of confronting a wife angry because he has been gone all night drinking. He declares,
"I know now how to tame a shrew,"
then quickly adds, "I dreamt upon it all this night till now." The Taming of the Shrew is a drunken man's dream, a mere appearance of reality, which evaporates when Sly wakes. Shakespeare leaves his audience with an uncomfortable ambiguity. Is the crushing and domestication of the rebellious woman appearance or reality? There is much in the work of William Shakespeare that is uncomfortable and ambiguous when he deals with women and their relationship to men. But to generalise about any aspect of Shakespeare is no easy matter, since he explored a bewildering range of emotions with extraordinary complexity and depth. In doing so, he produced the greatest body of dramatic literature since the Athenian dramatists of the 5th century, and filled it with poetry that ranks with that of Homer, Virgil, and Dante. So it is not surprising that misogyny is among the feelings with which he deals. In two of his greatest tragedies, it is expressed with a poetic intensity that is perhaps unrivalled, raising the question as to whether or not the world's greatest poet carried a deep-seated contempt for women. Women play key roles in a majority of his works. In his comedies, their love affairs are pivotal to the plot, and in these plays he presents the audience with a wide range of lovesick, ironic, romantic, rebellious, clever, deceptive, spirited, and independent women characters, a range unmatched by any other writer. However, unlike the Athenian tragedians, Shakespeare did not make women the central figures in his greatest dramas, his tragedies, all written in an incredible 10-year period of poetic achievement between 1599 and 1609. Though women are crucial to the main action of all the tragedies, the principal focus is on the hero and the weaknesses that undo him. That is, in the tragedies, Shakespeare's chief concern is with the qualities necessary for men to wield power and authority. In them, women do not challenge male authority as they do in the great Athenian tragedies, but their relationship to the hero is frequently the driving force that leads to his tragedy. Most famously, it is Lady Macbeth's ambition for her husband to be king that pushes him to murder and even to regicide, and Antony's infatuation for Cleopatra that inspires him to believe he can be sole ruler of Rome with her as his queen. In neither of these plays does the doomed hero decry or condemn the woman for the part she played in his downfall. Shakespeare does not use the opportunity, which a misogynist might view as ideal, to replay the Fall of Man theme with Lady Macbeth and Cleopatra in the predictable role of Eve or Pandora, bringing about man's destruction. Macbeth and Antony go to their deaths accepting full responsibility for their fate. However, in both Hamlet and King Lear, women are blamed not as individuals only, but as a sex in general for helping to bring about the hero's suffering and downfall. Because these are regarded generally as Shakespeare's two greatest works, they have led some to accuse him of being a misogynist or, at best, somewhat ambivalent about woman's worth and sexuality. It is not easy to draw conclusions about Shakespeare's attitude to women and sexuality from Hamlet. The play is an enigma and has been called the Mona Lisa of literature. At the same time as it has been praised as the greatest play ever written, it has been faulted as, most certainly, an artistic failure. The problem is the difficulty in identifying just what it is that Hamlet is actually about. Macbeth is about ambition, Antony and Cleopatra, passion, Coriolanus, pride, Othello, jealousy, King Lear, ingratitude. But Hamlet, which should have been the easiest of all to categorise, since it is on the surface at least a revenge play, eludes any such simple summary. If asked what the play is about, we can say that Hamlet's uncle Claudius has murdered his father the king, married his mother, and thus preempted Hamlet's succession to the throne. Hamlet must revenge his father's death. But we will have not even touched upon the intense, complex and turbulent emotions which spill out in some of the greatest poetry ever written. However, what makes Hamlet relevant to misogyny is the fact that one of those emotions, perhaps indeed the most powerful in the whole play, is an expression of his anger and disgust at his mother Gertrude for marrying his uncle. Even before Hamlet is alerted to his uncle's evil deed by the ghost of his father, we see him in a state of deep melancholy, verging on despair, because of Gertrude's hasty remarriage. His anger at her has become generalized into a profound disgust at the world and at the human body itself, which is the subject of the first of the play's great soliloquies, beginning, Act 1, Scene 2, "Oh, that this too sullied flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew." It is his mother's lust that has sullied the body and, as becomes apparent as the speech goes on, turned the world into an unweeded garden that grows to seed. Things rank and gross in nature possess it merely. That it should come to this. But 2 months dead, nay, not so much, not two. So excellent a king that was to this Hyperion to a satyr, so loving to my mother, that he might not beteem the winds of heaven visit her face too roughly. Heaven and earth must I remember. Why, she would hang on him, as if increase of appetite had grown by what it fed on, and yet within a month. Let me not think on't. Frailty, thy name is woman. Hamlet's first soliloquy reveals that he was angry with his mother even before her hasty remarriage. Gertrude's sexual attachment to his father is regarded with revulsion, even though, given his description of his father as the very paragon of royalty, it should not be a surprise that she found him so attractive. After Gertrude loses her husband, her apparently insatiable appetite has led her into the arms of a man her son compares to a satyr, the half-man, half-goat figure of Greek myth, the very embodiment of animal lust, often represented as possessing an exaggerated penis. Hamlet's denunciation of his mother turns into an attack on women that has become proverbial. Behind the disgust lurks the notion that once aroused, women's sexual desires are uncontrollable. Later in the play, Hamlet returns to the theme of his mother's sexual appetite as he presents her with a portrait of his father to compare to that of her current husband, Act 3, Scene 4.
You cannot call it love, for at your age the heyday in the blood is tame, it's humble, and waits upon the judgment. And what judgment would step from this to this?
Hamlet's angry outburst continues as he nearly makes himself sick, conjuring up an image of Gertrude and Claudius in bed together.
Nay, but to live in the rank sweat of an ensemed bed, stewed in corruption, honeying and making love over the nasty sty.
He expresses here a horror of human sexuality that belongs firmly to the misogynistic tradition of Christianity and might have issued from the pen of St. Augustine. But Hamlet's anger at his mother is also provoked by her own inadequacy. She is one of the most negative female characters that Shakespeare ever created. She is not particularly wicked, nor especially cunning, nor manipulative. Certainly, she is far from daring. Her rapid marriage to her dead husband's brother is not an act of boldness by a woman defying convention, but of weakness. And in spite of what Hamlet says about her, she does not appear as a monster of lust. Indeed, her chief characteristic is her passivity. One suspects that her son has exaggerated her carnality, and in doing so has revealed more about his own sexual obsessions than his mother's. Ophelia, the only other woman character in the play, suffers because of Hamlet's revulsion against female sexuality. Announcing, Act 3, Scene 2, that he no longer loves her, he tells her, "Get thee to a nunnery. Why wouldst thou be a breeder of sinners?" What follows is one of the most famous outbursts of misogyny in literature. "I have heard of your paintings well enough. God hath given you one face, but you make yourselves another. You gig and amble, and you lisp, you nickname God's creatures, and you make your wantonness your ignorance." Among the powerful emotions expressed in his speech, there is genuine bitterness and cruelty regarding Ophelia's desire to be a breeder of sinners, which once more suggests a deep-seated anger at women for, according to Christian theology, perpetuating the curse of original sin. But we must recall that in the same speech, Hamlet is trying to dupe Claudius and Polonius into believing that his unhappiness is caused by his problems with Ophelia, not with his uncle's usurpation of the throne. That is, the most famous outburst of misogyny in literature is in fact a rhetorical exercise on Hamlet's part, more related to his attempts to deceive his enemies than express his true feelings about Ophelia or women in general. Hamlet's main focus is on the relationship between a mother and her son. King Lear, the other play in which misogyny is a main theme, is centred on the relationship between a father and his daughters. It marked a noticeable change in emotional emphasis. According to a recent biographer of Shakespeare, after about 1606, the father-daughter bond becomes an almost obsessive theme in his work. If psychology has a theory of misogyny, it is one that traces its origins to the primal relationship between mother and son. Usually, by the time a man has daughters, his character is set, and even if they are as wicked as Lear's Goneril and Regan, their behaviour will not form their father's feelings about women in general, it will merely confirm it. For this reason, misogyny, however powerfully expressed in King Lear, is less central to the play's dynamic than it is in Hamlet. The plot merely affords Lear the opportunity to vent. Made homeless by Goneril and Regan, to whom the old king has foolishly given over his kingdom, abandoned to the elements, Lear erupts in one of the most powerful scenes in literature, Act 4, Scene 6. "Behold yon simpering dame, whose face between her forks presageth snow, that minces virtue, and does shake the head to hear of pleasure's name. The fit you, nor the soiled horse goes to it with a more riotous appetite. Down from the waist they're centaurs, though women all above. But to the girdle, to the gods inherit, beneath is all the fiends. There's hell, there's darkness, there's the sulphury pit, burning, scalding, stench, consumption. Fie, 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 pah! Give me an ounce of civet, good apothecary, to sweeten my imagination." Again, as in Hamlet, what begins as an attack on a particular woman, or a particular kind of woman, in this case one who parades false modesty, turns into a fierce denunciation of female sexuality. And once again, as with Gertrude and Desdemona in Othello, it is woman's appetite for sex that disgusts the hero and sours his imagination. But unlike Hamlet, King Lear is redeemed by a woman, his third daughter Cordelia, who stood up to him at the beginning of the play with a display of honesty that undercuts the play's misogyny. Refusing to flatter him with false praise, she demonstrates the link between truth and love that her father does not fully grasp until the end, and only at the cost of Cordelia's life, which she loses attempting to rescue him. Misogyny does not survive Shakespeare's tragic vision any more than do other follies that bring about human unhappiness. Pity, which springs from a profound sympathy for the human condition, as endured by men and women alike, replaces them as the dominant emotion of his greatest plays. The triumph of Shakespearean tragedy is that through pity it reveals that we share a common humanity, in which all distinctions, including those between men and women, are rendered insignificant. In the plays that followed, the works of his last years as a dramatist, such as The Tempest and The Winter's Tale, the diatribes against women, whether rhetorical or deeply felt, disappear. The prevailing mood is reconciliation, usually between father and daughter. The conflict between men and women is resolved satisfactorily in the relationship that a father has with his daughter. Elsewhere, misogyny showed its resilience throughout the 17th and 18th centuries in the face of social, moral, economic, and political developments that would profoundly transform women's status. In England, a dual process can be discerned. As a new model of family developed among the rising middle classes, with increased emphasis on mutual affection between man and wife, a breakdown in traditional sexual morality took place among the wits of the court circles of the post-1660 period that at times approached nihilism. Along with it appeared some of the most scurrilous poetic attacks on women since Juvenal. John Wilmot, the Earl of Rochester, 1647-80, the poet who penned some of the most exquisite love lyrics in the English language, including that beginning, "An age in her embraces past would seem a winter's day," could also describe a woman as "a passive pot for fools to spend in," that is, a chamber pot, and liken female genitalia to a sewer. The Earl of Rochester belonged to a new phenomenon, the first generation of rakes, young upper-class males who followed a libertine lifestyle, bawdy, open-minded, rebellious, irreligious, often politically progressive, and at the same time unrelenting satirists, as given to outbursts of misanthropic despair as they were to misogynistic verses. Theirs was a fierce rejection of the official Puritanism that had prevailed in the previous generation. They would set off a series of moral cycles in the West, with periods of sexual conservatism being followed by outbreaks of hedonism, followed by conservative reaction, which would last to this day. The rakes effectively created a subculture around the court of the Restoration period, 1660-88, where sex was pursued only for pleasure. On the continent, the same kind of hedonism prevailed at the court of Louis XIV, 1643-1713. It constituted a rebellion against Judeo-Christian sexual morality inspired by the humanism of Renaissance Italy. In the past, as in the Rome of the late Republic and early Empire, there had been comparable breakdowns of conventional morality among sections of the ruling class. But in general, they were severely punished. In the late 17th century, however, with the weakening of the authority of the churches and an emerging middle-class worldview from which a coherent morality had yet to be derived, no institution had the power to curb the new hedonism. The women who were part of the rakes' circle ranged in social status from lower-class prostitutes and actresses, then a novel feature on the social scene, to aristocratic ladies, some of whom, in reputation at least, were as promiscuous as the men. For the first time in English history, a few of them left behind their views of the erotic and verbal game in which they were so intensely engaged, crossing poetic swords with some of the sharpest wits of the period. The most famous, Aphra Behn, 1640-89, was renowned and vilified as a successful playwright and poet, the first English woman to achieve such literary fame. She was denounced as a lewd harlot who dared to describe how a young wife can sexually exhaust her husband and reduce him to a trembling wreck. She made literary history by giving the woman's version of premature ejaculation, for which male poets too often blamed their fair nymphs. In her poem The Disappointment, the hapless swain is accused of trying to prolong his pleasure, which too much love destroys, and so finds his vast pleasure turned to pain. For their part, the rake's attitude to women was at once decorous and coarse, oscillating between adoration and contempt, which was usually born of disappointment or rejection. There was also a strong strain of anxiety about their sexual performance, which is seen in the number of poems about impotence and the court lady's increasing use of dildos. The fact that the dildo was from the 1660s onwards, usually of Italian manufacture, increased the upper-class English male's sexual angst, since Italy was associated with an effeminizing eroticism. For an Englishman, what could be more humiliating than to be superannuated by an Italian dildo? The rakes broke no new ground in the chronicles of misogyny, except that in the explicitness and coarseness of their language they foreshadowed the first of those that we would recognise as pornographers. Indeed, Wilmot was treated as such until relatively recently. In 1926, an edition of his poems was seized in New York by the police and destroyed. However, the rakes were unlike pornographers in several important ways. One was that they dealt with the frustrations of sex as well as its delights, being as frank about their episodes of impotence as about their conquests. There also prevailed a feeling, particularly powerful in Rochester's case, that the pursuit of sexual pleasure is just another one of life's transient absurdities. By the late 17th century, a significant number of people saw sex as an activity independent of procreation and love. Biology, of course, still imposed constraints on the ability of men, and more so women, to act out that view, the condom and the dildo notwithstanding. Though it is a view that has been met with more than one conservative moral backlash, it has continued to thrive in Western society, regardless of all attempts to suppress or contain it. However, it was far from being the dominant morality, nor was it the one that would determine the shape misogyny would take in the coming centuries. By the early 18th century in England and Holland, thanks to the huge expansion in overseas trade, the mercantile middle class had established itself as a political power to be reckoned with. It had forged a moral code to reflect its priorities. It was a moral code that was in some ways conservative, stressing the virtues of frugality, thrift, hard work, and sexual restraint. But, thanks to its revolutionary emphasis on the needs and importance of the individual, it made it increasingly difficult to deny women their full share of humanity, even as misogyny refashioned itself to fit aspects of the new dominant morality. During the early 18th century, a new literary form arose to embody that individualism, the novel. It would play a unique role in women's history. For the first time, characters were portrayed as individuals, living their lives in an actual time and an actual place. The novel was true to women's experience in ways no previous literature had attempted. Before, the great poets and dramatists had presented characters and plots that stayed faithful to certain universal types, derived from mythology or history, and intended not so much to represent an individual, but to embody some general truth about life. These truths were held to be timeless, unchanging Platonic absolutes, contrasting with the ephemera of individual experience. In contrast, the novel, from its very beginnings in the work of Daniel Defoe, 1660 to 1731, relies on realistic detail to tell the stories of characters. We get to know Defoe's characters Moll Flanders and Roxana in an intimate way, quite unlike the way we know Medea or King Lear. The novel was an instrument for exploring the personal lives of recognisable people, and as such allowed the presentation of women characters and their relationships in a completely new way. It is no coincidence that the novel was also the first literary form that women's tastes and concerns helped to shape. Nor is it a surprise that, though its earliest practitioners were men, it would soon become the genre in which women excelled more than in any other. By the end of the 18th century in England, there were more women novelists than men. The prosperity of the middle classes in England had been accompanied by an expansion of the reading public and an information explosion, with printing presses appearing all over London, producing pamphlets, and the first newspapers and magazines. Furthermore, an increasing number of women had more free time on their hands. Because of an enduring Protestant distrust of the theatre as being somewhat disreputable, a large number of those women turned to the novel for entertainment. Its appeal to the middle class and to women was evident. You did not need a classical education or knowledge of Greek and Roman history to enjoy Moll Flanders. Its author, after all, had been educated in a trade school and had practised a trade, first as a hosiery merchant, then as a pamphleteer and journalist. The fact that novels often featured women characters in lead roles was also a powerful attraction to women readers. Two of Defoe's four greatest novels are about women, Moll Flanders, 1722, and Roxana, 1724. He was a strong advocate for women's education. Apart from everything else, he was a successful author who realised the importance of women as readers. Defoe also helped influence the growing opinion that opposed parents forcing daughters to marry against their will, which he likened to rape. As a spokesman for the middle classes, he stressed the importance of love in marriage and argued, "To say love is not essential to a form of marriage is true, but to say that it is not essential to the felicity of the married state is not true." However, as a God-fearing Protestant, he warned against lewdness or sexual passion as a reason to marry, claiming in a pamphlet that it brings madness, desperation, ruin of families, self-murders, killing of bastards, etc. However, the moral message that his novels convey is not quite so unambiguous. All Defoe's characters are basically like his first and most famous Robinson Crusoe. They are shipwrecks. Crusoe is shipwrecked by storm at sea. Roxana, on the other hand, is shipwrecked by a foolish, selfish husband who abandons her and her five children to starve. The stories are all tales of survival under difficult circumstances. Roxana survives and prospers by becoming a whore and courtesan to a series of rich men. A predictable enough, if not respectable, route for a beautiful woman to take, it might be thought, and Defoe tries to reassure the reader with frequent moral asides, stressing that he is not recommending that women should follow his heroine's example. But Roxana does not conform to the prevailing stereotypes of women, and though Defoe does his best to disapprove of her, it is evident throughout the novel that his admiration for her as an economic success story overcomes his conventional moralizing against how she makes her money. Most importantly, she is not governed by love, but by the desire to preserve the autonomy that she has achieved thanks to her economic success. A considerable part of the novel is about how she manages her money. In doing so, she redefines her relationship with men. She rejects marriage when proposed to by a man who loves her because, she says, "Though I could give up my virtue and expose myself, I could not give up my money." She explains, "My heart was bent upon an independency of fortune, and I told him I knew no state of matrimony but what was at best a state of inferiority, if not bondage, that I had no notion of it, that I lived a life of absolute liberty now, was as free as I was born, and having a plentiful fortune, I did not understand what coherence the words honour and obey had with the liberty of a free woman." Even when pregnant, she resists the offer of marriage. Defoe reverses the usual situation. It is the father that is pleading for marriage to the mother on behalf of their unborn child. Roxana rejects him, and he is stunned. "For it was never known," he responds, "that any woman refused to marry a man that had first lain with her, much less a man that had gotten her with child. But you go upon different notions from all the world, and though you reason it so strongly that a man knows hardly what to answer, yet I must own there is something in it shocking to nature." Roxana's concern about the security of her fortune accurately reflects the legal situation of married women in the 18th century, which was still governed by patriarchal notions that went back to Roman times. On marriage, a woman's property became her husband's. This would remain the case until well into the 19th century. In the end, Roxana does marry for a title and only after the strictest measures are in force for preserving the independence of her fortune. The strongest characters in her story are all women, and the most intense relationships are between them. The male characters are passive, insubstantial creatures who do not even have names, mere rungs on the ladder of Roxana's climb to the top. Just as Robinson Crusoe was the portrait of the autonomous man, forging an independent life for himself against all the odds, Roxana is his female equivalent, the first vision of an autonomous woman that we have. Throughout the novel, she is called an Amazon, a member of the legendary tribe of warrior women who lived without men, an indication of the deep-seated and continuing anxiety that the notion of an autonomous woman inspires. For women, the middle-class values that opened up visions of individuality would prove to be fraught with ambiguities. The new morality of the middle class resembled the old in its identification of a woman's worth with her chastity. The middle-class wife and mother of the new model family, while she was expected to be able to comfort her husband sexually, was also being increasingly represented as a person for whom sexual pleasure was not important. Her virtue became propaganda in the moral war the middle class fought against the wastrels and degenerates of the aristocracy. The image of the good middle-class wife of the 18th century would prepare the way for the fainting, sexless Victorian maidens of the 19th. The resilience of misogyny can be explained partly by the fact that misogynists have always had it both ways. Perhaps comparable to the way Nazi propaganda portrayed Jews as both Bolshevists and bankers, misogynists have either condemned women for being sexually insatiable or denied they had any sexual desires at all. In this contradictory dualism, women were viewed as either insatiable sexual predators or chaste and virtuous sexual victims. This dualism clearly manifested itself in the 1740s. The greatest poet of the age, Alexander Pope, 1688 to 1744, in such poems as To a Lady, summed up one aspect of traditional misogynistic thinking. Some men to business, some to pleasure take, but every woman is at heart a rake. A completely opposite view of women appeared around the same time with the publication of Pamela, or Virtue Rewarded, the first novel by Samuel Richardson. Richardson, a printer and the son of a carpenter, was commissioned by a publisher to write a volume of letters that would teach the innocent, or presumed innocent, daughters of the middle class how to conduct themselves when working as servants in the homes of the aristocracy. Pamela was the tale of how a virtuous young woman resists the multifarious and determined attempts of her employer, Mr. B., a rake, to seduce her. Pamela declares that her maxim is, "May I never survive one moment, that fatal one, in which I shall forfeit my innocence." Faced with her impregnable purity, Mr. B. finally gives up and proposes marriage. Pamela reconsiders all her previous moral objections to him, and deciding he is not such a bad chap after all, accepts. By the novel's end, thanks to his wife's sterling example, the rake has become a Puritan. It was not, of course, the first tale of a virtuous woman resisting a lustful male, but it was the first time a servant girl was accorded that heroic role, proving that while the aristocracy may still be socially superior to the rising middle class, the middle class were their moral superiors. Pamela enjoyed extraordinary success, first in England, where it went through four editions in a short time, and then in France. Among its most devoted readers were middle-class women. For this reason, the novel is a landmark in the history of women as well as of literature. By making Pamela a bestseller, for the first time women, at least middle-class women, had exercised their say over what they wanted from writers. And what they chose was Pamela, a parable of middle-class feminine purity pitted against the desires of the rapacious upper-class male. Its lead character provided a model for the daughters of merchants, printers, and haberdashers to emulate. But the parable contained a deep moral ambiguity. Was Pamela being pure for purity's sake, or merely as a lure to entrap Mr. B.? Pamela's purity is clearly, for Mr. B., an irresistible incitement to lust. The English middle classes were not the first to discover the powerful sexual allure of the virtuous woman. The original good girl, Lucretia, was raped because her virtue was so sexually provocative. As the supreme Puritan Angelo put it in Shakespeare's Measure for Measure, Act 2, Scene 3, "Can it be that modesty can more betray our sense than woman's lightness? Angelo, dost thou desire to use her foully for those things that make her good?" The answer from the Mr. B's of this world is a resounding yes. The success of Pamela among women raises another, more interesting question. Clearly, it indicates that a sizable section of women identified with a character who was at best unbelievably naive and at worst incredibly manipulative. It should not be surprising that women readers should have absorbed these misogynistic stereotypes, but it remains somewhat ironic that exercising their power for the first time as an important part of the reading public, they helped make them into a bestseller. With the growth in power and influence of the middle classes, the ideal of the sexless woman became a standard for society, not only in England, but also in the philosophical and social writings of Jean-Jacques Rousseau in France in the late 18th century, and in North America. This standard stressed that the differences between men and women fully explained their different status, the most important of them being the strength of sexual desire in one and its relative absence in the other. Women found themselves dehumanized, this time in the name of purity. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, 1712-78, probably one of the most influential misogynists of all time, took the ideal of the pure woman who uses her virtue as a sexual allure and turned it into an inescapable fact of nature. Dissembling and manipulation were assigned to her as her defining characteristics. "Whether the woman shares the man's passions or not," he wrote in an account of the ideal woman and her education in what became an international bestseller, "whether she is willing or unwilling to satisfy it, she always repulses him and defends herself, though not always with the same vigour, and therefore not always with the same success." This is merely a roundabout way of asserting that women say no even when they mean yes, the same logic that has frequently been used as a defence in rape trials. Rousseau stood on the brink of the French Revolution. He was a product of the Age of Enlightenment, but the harbinger of the Romantic movement, the intellectual, artistic, and moral revolution that would replace it. The old authorities, philosophical and religious, had been overthrown. The universe was now seen to be governed by laws that the human intellect could discover and understand through the use of reason. But it was reason, meant to rid the world of outmoded prejudices, that Rousseau invoked to justify his belief that woman was the sex that ought to obey. He asserted, "Women do wrong to complain of the inequality of man-made laws. This inequality is not of man's making, or at any rate it is not the result of mere prejudice, but of reason." That reason was derived from what he saw as the natural order of things. Since nature has entrusted woman with the care of the children, she must hold herself responsible for them to their father. The keystone of Rousseau's thinking was that man was corrupted the further away he grew from nature. Civilization, and all its iniquities, including selfishness, inequality, and greed, is a result of the natural man being uprooted from his original state of existence, which Rousseau equated with innocence. However, one thing had not changed, and should not change, and that was the natural subordination of women to men. The will of nature now replaced the will of God in determining the fate and status of women. Not surprisingly, in Rousseau's vision of primitive man, men and women lived separate lives, mating when they met and then moving on, with the women raising their offspring by themselves without any help or concern from the fathers. It was an 18th-century version of the old myth of male autonomy. He also returned to the Greeks for a model of how women should be treated, and admired their policy of segregation of the sexes as practiced in its most extreme version by the Athenians. He practiced the contempt for women that he preached, dumping the 5 children that he had with his mistress, Thérèse Levasseur, in foundling homes. She could neither read nor write. He seems to have enjoyed the feeling of intellectual superiority that he derived from this relationship, for though he taught her to write, she never learnt to read, nor count, nor remember the names of the months of the year. Nor is it surprising that Rousseau admired the novels of Richardson, since he too believed that chasteness inflames men's desires, and nothing was quite as sexy as a simpering virgin who knew her place. However, another view of women, a glimpse of which we caught in Defoe's novel Roxana, challenged Rousseau and Richardson's version of misogyny. It might seem something of a paradox that this counterview, in which women were seen as highly sexual beings, capable of achieving independence and status, found its most dramatic and uncompromising expression in 18th-century pornography. But then, the relationship between misogyny, pornography, and the status of women is one of the most contentious that can be found. While it is probably a safe generalization that philosophers and priests have done more harm to women than pornographers, it is not an assertion that most people will today readily accept. But there are many things about pornography that people will not accept, including what exactly it means. To describe something as pornographic is like asserting that such and such an organization is terrorist. It is primarily a value judgment, describing something, acts or things or goals, of which you disapprove. The problem is, values change, and what seemed pornographic to a Victorian lady would not seem so to an American teenage girl who is a fan of rap music. However, one thing is certain. Pornography is inextricably linked to the emergence of modernity. It was not called pornography at the time. In English, the word only came to be used in its current sense in the mid-19th century, but many characteristics of the genre were established at the dawn of the modern age, which remain typical of it today. The explicit description in words or pictures of sexual acts is still pornography's hallmark. But its satirical and political dimension, which in France especially made it an important vehicle for anti-clerical and anti-government attacks right up to the French Revolution, had disappeared by the late 1790s. Until then, pornography had played a vital propaganda role in the events leading up to the Revolution, and its association with social disorder and political radicalism was one of the reasons it was later suppressed in England. At first, during the 16th and most of the 17th century, the distribution of pornography was restricted to upper-class circles. But the invention of the novel did for early pornography what the video recorder did for its 20th century descendant. By the early 18th century, a popular pornography industry existed in France, and by the middle of the century in England. From there, in 1748, came what perhaps was the biggest-selling pornographic book of all time, Fanny Hill, or The Memoirs of a Woman of Pleasure, by James Cleland. One of the most popular forms of pornographic writing in the 18th century, the fictional autobiography or confessions of whores and prostitutes, directly challenged the image of the sexless, pure woman, the perennial victim of male lust that was taking hold among the middle class in England and exalted in the works of Rousseau in France. The memoirs of the libertine whore, as she has been called, describe women who are sexually aggressive, self-confident, capable of almost limitless sexual pleasure, financially successful, and usually indifferent or hostile to the ordinary notions that define conventional femininity, such as motherhood and marriage. Sexual differences between men and women, in fact, are all but erased in the search for pleasure, fulfillment, and domination. In the world of the libertine whore, women are as passionate as men and as willing to fulfil their own desires. The most extreme example is the Marquis de Sade's The History of Juliet, or The Fortunes of Vice. Sade, 1740 to 1814, remains the most infamous writer of all time, from whose name we derive the word sadism. He spent almost half his life imprisoned, mostly for what would now be regarded as petty or non-crimes, and wrote most of his work behind bars. Three-quarters of that work has been lost or destroyed, and what remains suffered from severe censorship. It presents a picture of sexual excess unrivalled in the history of literature, in which sadistic orgies are as carefully choreographed as the dance steps in Broadway musicals. It is not surprising that in this work, Sade was accused of attacking the very idea of what it is to be human. However, Sard was writing within less than a century of the last woman who was tortured and burned alive as a witch. We, who lie on the other side of the horrors of the 20th century, are not so shocked by his revelations about the lust for power lurking in the human heart. Juliet is a new species, a sort of Tyrannosaurus sex. Though in the tradition of the libertine whore bent on achieving autonomy, Juliet does so regardless of the cost to the other human beings who are her victims, both male and female, whom she tortures and murders for sexual fulfilment. In the world of Juliet, there are no men and no women, there are only the powerful and the weak, the master and the slave, those who are willing and able to use their power to achieve their aims, and those who cannot and who become their victims. A zealous egalitarian, she tells a king, I have never considered one living creature any better than any other, and as I have no belief in moral virtues, neither do I consider that they are differentiated by any moral worth. Sard mocks and derides Rousseau's vision of the ideal woman by showing that if, as he believed, and history tends to bear him out, the instinct for power is part of human nature, then women can possess it as much as men, and will be every bit as cruel in exercising it. Juliet shows she can sink to the same depths of inhumanity as any man. Her capacity for evil is not moderated by her gender. Through cruelty and violence, therefore, Juliet achieves a kind of equality with men unique for a woman in the history of literature and ideas, but only in a world where absolute contempt for women has been replaced by absolute contempt for the weak. It was not the kind of equality that women were seeking in the real world. That would emerge as the legacy of the Enlightenment unfolded in the following century, along with its contradictions, to confront misogyny on fresh grounds in both Europe and new or little-known worlds.